My name is Michael McCusker. Today, Jamie Linton. She used to write poems and send them to me when I was publishing the Times Eagle, the North Coast Times Eagle. And I would like to read one of her poems. It's called Hidden. And she wrote it when she was 16, a junior in high school at Estacada. Hidden. In a distant place during distant times, people are still people. Generation after generation of changes, yet nobody truly understands what makes a person go around. Unpredictable, always changing, each person different from another. A person who follows another has not yet found themselves. The real problem is hidden underneath the cover of someone else. But they are still there, somewhere, somewhere deep inside. Why is it harder to be yourself than to be like someone else? Time after time, you realize that this is true. It doesn't seem it should be this way, but things that should never seem to be. And that is Jamie Linton. And she wrote that when she was 16. And sort of in the same vein, I'd like to read something by Stephen Burke. He has a regular column. Those of you who read Hipfish know. Small is Beautiful by Stephen Burke. I take my title from a book published in 1976 by the late decentralist British economist E.F. Schumacher. It was a series of essays focused on small, low-energy projects for developing local economies in places like rural India. Critics of modern technological society at that time were attracted to Schumacher, together with anarchistic writers like Ivan Ilyich, whose Tools for Conviviality emphasized the utility of well-designed hand tools in small, manageable communities instead of mammoth machines that alter and kill the earth. While most Americans continued to worship technological progress, a few of the more sensitive were beginning to understand that development must have limits. Much of the 1970s, a period I call the inter-imperium, saw a good deal of this dissenting thought. In 1972, scholars in the Club of Rome published The Limits to Growth, drawing inspiration from recent photographs of the Earth from the Moon. They suggested the analogy of spaceship Earth, a beautiful green and blue ball in space that was the fragile mother of life in all its complex oceanic and terrestrial ecosystems. How long could a planet with limited resources endure the plundering juggernaut of machine technology? The inter-imperium saw the United States face a number of setbacks to its glorified self-image as free world leader and most technologically advanced society on Earth. Our inability to keep a small, peasant nation in Southeast Asia from going communist, Vietnam, followed by the Watergate affair, with its televised exposure of deep corruption in high government places, brought a crisis of confidence. Another less immediately noticed but more ominous event occurred almost simultaneously, the reaching of peak oil extraction in the United States in 1972, signifying ever-growing dependence on largely Middle Eastern sources. The American people were shocked into awareness of this issue in 1973, following the Nixon administration's decision to ship needed arms and ammunition to the Israelis, fighting to hold on to land they had taken from Egypt, Syria, and the Palestinian Arabs 6 years earlier, during the Six-Year War in 1967. The Arabs had all but regained the land, but U.S. arms enabled the Israelis to turn the tide. The result was that the newly formed Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, Middle Eastern Arab states, now acted to punish the U.S. by embargoing oil. This was the first of the oil shocks of the 70s. Cars lined up for blocks around gas stations as people sat for hours and the price of gas took its first sharp spike upward. When a new president, Jimmy Carter, began to speak to Americans of an energy crisis, he understood that growth must be controlled and that the U.S. needed to be more parsimonious with its limited resources. He began the practice of granting subsidies for people who put in solar panels to lower energy use, and he had them installed on the White House. As he spoke from the White House, he lowered the thermostat and donned a woolen sweater to demonstrate what Americans needed to do. But Americans who had experienced the two greatest decades of prosperity in our history following the Great Depression and World War II were in no mood for any sort of rationing. Nope, bigger and more always equaled better. Moreover, conserving energy meant curbing growth, and this would be bad for the economy, which was designed to continuously increase to provide more people with more jobs and the money to buy endless amounts of consumer goods. The economic elites spurned Carter's warning, using their actor President Reagan to bury it under an avalanche of chauvinistic happy talk. Reagan also took off the solar panels off the White House. They redoubled American militarism to access ever scarcer resources and created neoliberalism, the hypercapitalism that is now the world's integrated economic system. At this point, most Americans are aware they've been had and are ruled by self-serving financial oligarchy. But globalization is so wasteful that it is unsustainable. Resources are running out, and the oil and high-tech economy that is now so familiar to us will soon be unavailable to the many. Add the factor of accelerating climate change, and we have what social critic James Kunstler calls the long emergency. The most rational response to our present predicament is to get back to the small is beautiful idea through the fast-growing localization movement. Effective localism means that people need to help one another, to act as communities and not as isolated households. The end of the car culture will help that occur. It will force people once again to live and work within walking or at least bicycling distance. We can redesign life around smaller, more self-sufficient communities, and in doing so, we can draw on a rich American past. We need to regenerate a culture of artisanship and agriculture centered on local markets. This is a sustainable economy based on stasis rather than growth. It is giving up what Lewis Mumford called the myth of the machine, which was also a title of one of his books, and finding more equitable, cooperative, and natural ways to live. And that is Small is Beautiful by Stephen Burke. And now I'd like to read something by Wendell Berry, which actually he gave as a commemoration speech at the College of the Atlantic in Bar Harbor, Maine, in 1989, and which was reprinted in Harper's Magazine in September that year. I have it because some friends of mine sent it to me in a letter probably about that year. I have been going through old letters thinking that maybe I should toss them out, but I'm not going to. They're too close to me, I guess. And Larry and Marge sent me this particular article by Wendell Berry, The Futility of Global Thinking. Toward the end of As You Like It, Orlando says, I can live no longer by thinking. He is ready to marry Rosalind. It is time for incarnation. Having thought too much, he is at one of the limits of human experience or of human sanity. If his love does not put on flesh, we know he must sooner or later arrive at the opposite limit, at which he will say, I can live no longer without thinking. Thought, even consciousness, seems to live between these limits, the abstract and the particular, the world and the flesh. All public movements of thought quickly produce a language that works as a code, useless to the extent that it is abstract. It is readily evident, for example, that you can't conduct a relationship with another person in terms of the rhetoric of the civil rights movement or the women's movement, as useful as those rhetorics may initially have been to personal relationships. The same is true of the environment movement. The favorite adjective of this movement now seems to be planetary. This word is used properly enough to refer to the interdependence of places and to the recognition, which is desirable and growing, that no place on the earth can be completely healthy until all places are. But the word planetary also refers to an abstract anxiety or an abstract passion that is desperate and useless exactly to the extent that it is abstract. How, after all, can anybody, any particular body, do anything to heal a planet? Nobody can do anything to heal a planet. The suggestion that anybody could do so is preposterous. The heroes of abstraction keep galloping in on their white horses to save the planet, and they keep falling off in front of the grandstand. What we need, obviously, is a more intelligent, which is to say, a more accurate, description of the problem. The description of a problem as planetary arouses a motivation for which, of necessity, there is no employment. The adjective planetary describes a problem in such a way that it cannot be solved. In fact, though we now have serious problems nearly everywhere on the planet, we have no problem that can accurately be described as planetary. And short of the total annihilation of the human race, there is no planetary solution. There are also no national, state, or county problems, and no national, state, or county solutions. That will-o'-the-wisp, the large-scale solution to the large-scale problem, which is so dear to governments, universities, and corporations, serves mostly to distract people from the small, private problems that they may, in fact, have the power to solve. The problems, if we describe them accurately, are all private and small, or they are so initially. The problems are our lives. In the developed countries, and that's a quote, at least, the large problems occur because all of us are living either partly wrong or almost entirely wrong. It was not just the greed of corporate shareholders and the hubris of corporate executives that put the fate of Prince William Sound in 1889 into one ship, the Exxon Valdez. It was also our demand that energy be cheap and plentiful. The economies of our communities and households are wrong. The answers to the human problems of ecology are to be found in economy. And the answers to the problems of economy are to be found in culture and in character. To fail to see this is to go on dividing the world falsely between guilty producers and innocent consumers. The planetary versions, the heroic versions, of our problems have attracted great intelligence. Our problems, as they are caused and suffered in our lives, our households, and our communities, have attracted very little intelligence. There are some notable exceptions. A few people have learned to do a few things better. But it is discouraging to reflect that, though we have been talking about most of our problems for decades, we are still, mainly, talking about them. The civil rights movement has not given us better communities. The women's movement has not given us better marriages or better households. The environment movement has not changed our parasitic relationship to nature. We have failed to produce new examples of good home and community economies, and we have nearly completed the destruction of the examples we once had. Without examples, we are left with theory and the bureaucracy and the meddling that come with theory. We change our principles, our thoughts, and our words, but these are changes made in the air. Our lives go on unchanged. For the most part, the subcultures, the countercultures, the dissenters, and the opponents continue mindlessly, or perhaps just helplessly, to follow the pattern of the dominant society in its extravagance, its wastefulness, its dependencies, and its addictions. The old problem remains. How do you get intelligence out of an institution or an organization? My small community in Kentucky has lived and dwindled for a century, at least under the influence of four kinds of organizations: governments, corporations, schools, and churches, all of which are distant, either actually or in interest, centralized, and consequently abstract in their concerns. Governments and corporations, except for employees, have no presence in our community at all, which is perhaps fortunate for us, but we nevertheless feel the indifference or the contempt of governments and corporations for communities such as ours. We have had no school of our own for nearly 30 years. The school system takes our young people, prepares them for the world of tomorrow, and that's a quote, which it does not expect to take place in any rural area, and gives back expert, that is, extremely generalized, ideas. The church is present in the town. We have two churches, but both have been used by their denominations for almost a century to provide training and income for student ministers who do not stay long enough even to become disillusioned. For a long time, then, the minds that have most influenced our town have not been of the town, and so have not tried even to perceive, much less to honor, the good possibilities that are there. They have not wondered on what terms a good and conserving life might be lived there. In this, my community is not unique, but is like almost every other neighborhood in our country and in the, once again, quote, developed world. The question that must be addressed, therefore, is not how to care for the planet, but how to care for each of the planet's millions of human and natural neighborhoods, each of its millions of small pieces and parcels of land, each one of which is in some precious way different from all the others. Our understandable wish to preserve the planet must somehow be reduced to the scale of our competence. That is, to the wish to preserve all of its humble households and neighborhoods. What can accomplish this reduction? I will say again, without overweening hope, but with certainty nonetheless, that only love can do it. Only love can bring intelligence out of the institutions and organizations where it grandizes itself into the presence of the work that must be done. Love is never abstract. It does not adhere to the universe or the planet or the nation or the institution or the profession, but to the singular sparrows of the street, the lilies of the field, the least of these, my brethren. And that's a quote. Love is not, by its own desire, heroic. It is heroic only when compelled to be. It exists by its willingness to be anonymous, humble, and unrewarded. The older love becomes, the more clearly it understands its involvement in partiality, imperfection, suffering, and mortality. Even so, it longs for incarnation. It can live no longer by thinking. And yet, to put on flesh and do the flesh's work, it must think. In his essay on Kipling, George Orwell wrote, "All left-wing parties in the highly and industrialized countries are at bottom a sham, because they make it their business to fight against something which they do not really wish to destroy. They have internationalist aims, and at the same time they struggle to keep up a standard of life with which those aims are incompatible. We all live by robbing Asiatic coolies, and those of us who are enlightened," a quote, "all maintain that those coolies ought to be set free. but our standard of living, and hence our enlightenment, demands that the robbery shall continue. This statement of Orwell's is clearly applicable to our situation now. All we need do is change a few nouns. The religion and the environmentalism of the highly industrialized countries are at bottom a sham, because they make it their business to fight against something that they really do not wish to destroy. We all live by robbing nature, but our standard of living demands that the robbery shall continue. We must achieve the character and acquire the skills to live much poorer than we do. We must waste less. We must do more for ourselves and each other. It is either that or continue merely to think and talk about changes that we are inviting catastrophe to make. The great obstacle is simply this: the conviction that we cannot change because we are dependent upon what is wrong. But that is the addict's excuse, and we know that it will not do. How dependent, in fact, are we? How dependent are our neighborhoods and communities? How might our dependence be reduced? To answer these questions will require better thoughts and better deeds than we have been capable of so far. We must have the sense and the courage, for example, to see that the ability to transport food for hundreds or thousands of miles does not necessarily mean that we are well off. It means that the food supply is more vulnerable and more costly than a local food supply would be. It means that consumers do not control or influence the healthfulness of their food supply, and that they are at the mercy of the people who have the control and influence. It means that in eating, people are using large quantities of petroleum that other people in another time are almost certain to need. I am trying not to mislead you or myself about our situation. I think that we have hardly begun to realize the gravity of the mess we are in. Our most serious problem, perhaps, is that we have become a nation of fantasists. We believe, apparently, in the infinite availability of finite resources. We persist in land use methods that reduce the potentially infinite power of soil fertility to a finite quantity, which we then proceed to waste as if it were an infinite quantity. We have an economy that depends not upon the quality and quantity of necessary goods and services, but on the behavior of a few stockholders. We believe that democratic freedom can be preserved by people ignorant of the history of democracy and indifferent to the responsibilities of freedom. Our leaders have been for many years as oblivious to the realities and dangers of their time as were George III and Lord North. They believe that the difference between war and peace is still the overriding political difference, when in fact the difference has diminished to the point of insignificance. How would you describe the difference between modern war and modern industry? Between, say, bombing and strip mining, or between chemical warfare and chemical manufacturing? The difference seems to be only that in war, the victimization of humans is directly intentional, and in industry, it is accepted as a trade-off. Were the catastrophes of Love Canal, Bhopal, Chernobyl, and the Exxon Valdez episodes of war or of peace? They were, in fact, peacetime acts of aggression, intentional to the extent that the risks were known and ignored. We are involved unremittingly in a war, not against foreign enemies, but against the world, against our freedom, and indeed against our existence. Our so-called industrial accidents should be looked upon as revenges of nature. We forget that nature is necessarily party to all our enterprises and that she imposes conditions of her own. Now she is plainly saying to us, if you put the fates of whole communities or cities or regions or ecosystems at risk in single ships or factories or power plants, then I will furnish the drunk or the fool or the imbecile who will make the necessary small mistake. and soul. My advice is simply my hope for us all. Beware the justice of nature. Understand that there can be no successful human economy apart from nature or in defiance of nature. Understand that no amount of education can overcome the innate limits of human intelligence and responsibility. We are not smart enough or conscious enough or alert enough to work responsibly on a gigantic scale. In making things always bigger and more centralized, we make them both more vulnerable in ourselves, in themselves, and more dangerous to everything else. Learn, therefore, to prefer small-scale elegance and generosity to large-scale greed, cruelty, crudity, and glamour. Make a home. Help to make a community. Be loyal to what you have made. Put the interest of the community first. Love your neighbors, not the neighbors you pick out, but the ones you have. Love this miraculous world that we did not make, that is a gift to us. As far as you are able, make your lives dependent on your local place, neighborhood, and household, which thrive by care and generosity, and independent of the industrial economy, which thrives by damage. Find work, if you can, that does no damage. Enjoy your work. Work well. And that was The Futility of Global Thinking by Wendell Berry, which he spoke as a graduation commemoration in 1999 to the College of the Atlantic in Bar Harbor, Maine. As Stephen Burke said, small is beautiful. And now I'd like to finish up with Remembering Rachel by Robert Brake from Ocean Park, Washington. April 14th marks the 50th anniversary of the death of Rachel Carson, eloquent author of the bristling polemic Silent Spring in 1962. The gentle, subversive, well-reasoned, timelessly relevant argument was simple. Rigorously test the health and environmental impact of synthetic chemicals before they are widely distributed into the environment. A catalyst of the modern environmental movement, Rachel Carson endured vicious attacks from the chemical industries and agribusinesses. Character assassins compared her to Hitler and unfairly roughed her up in the New York Times. More recently, the libertarian Cato Institute, co-founded in 1977 by chemical merchant David Koch, marked the 50th anniversary of Silent Spring with its own contrarian publication titled The False Crises of Rachel Carson. Carson's detractors characterized her as an emotional spinster alarmist, a communist, a kook, and a quack, despite her impeccable qualifications as a marine biologist and esteemed writer of extraordinary moral and ecological vision. While Carson was conducting her research for Silent Spring, many Americans believed that toxins and pollutants vanished when dumped in nearby lakes and rivers. Auto exhaust disappeared into thin air. Asbestos was a miracle material, and smoking was good for you. Ronald Reagan shilled Chesterfields, and doctors preferred Camels. Today, we should reacquaint ourselves with Rachel Carson's eloquently expressed truths and respect the enormous personal price she paid to wage her crusade. She rightly condemned our arrogance and myopia toward nature and compelled us to reevaluate our relationship with our environment. 52 years ago, she advised, "We stand now where two roads diverge. The road we have long been traveling is deceptively easy, but at its end lies disaster. The other fork of the road, the one less traveled by, offers our only chance to reach a destination that assures the preservation of the earth." And that was a quote from Rachel Carson. And I just read Remembering Rachel by Dr. Robert Brake of Ocean Park, Washington. And this has been Michael McCusker. I might see you again next week if I do not fall into the river, the sky doesn't fall, or one of those drones catches me on the sidewalk.